Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Needs Some Introduction. As usual, I'm your host, Victor, and in today's episode, I'm discussing a really interesting film, Anatomy of a Fall. This was a French production that actually won the Cannes Award for Best Film in 2023, and then became one of the very rare instances when a foreign language film, was nominated for Best Picture here in the U.S., and if you did watch the Academy Awards, you did see that this film had quite a few nominations and won Best Original Screenplay. This is now available on Hulu if you haven't seen it yet. I highly recommend this film, perhaps my favorite film of the year. And that's a little insight into me. I obviously loved the Avatar movie last year, for example. I highly rated Oppenheimer this year. A lot of that has to do with spectacle and scale and using the film format, the size of the frame, etc. But in many ways, especially for home viewing, because I did watch this at home, I did not see it in the theater, I do like when a film is able to put me into someone else's perspective, make me see things in a different way. And honestly, in this film, which is a court procedural that takes place in France, I wasn't even familiar with this French judicial system. So all of this was really, really interesting to me. And I'm always fascinated by the mystery of people in general and how there's an interior version of yourself, there's an exterior version of yourself, at least those two versions, and the dichotomy there and the unknowability of another person. So these are some of my favorite themes in literature and in art. And of course, this film delves into it in great detail. So once again, that's Anatomy of a Fall. It's available on Hulu. Do check it out. Do listen to our conversation. We do get into spoilers. So if you're wary of spoilers, do check out the film before you listen to this conversation. Although we do speak spoiler-free for the first third of the conversation. But we do, I mean, this film, you really do need to get into spoilers. So we definitely spoil the film as we go through it. There is a warning in the podcast when that happens. In the near future, check this feed. I plan to discuss the Roadhouse original versus Roadhouse remake, which just dropped on Amazon Prime. Very different from this film, Anatomy of a Fall. Although I like all kinds of films. But I'm very interested in just the concept of what is a bad movie. Maybe that's the beginning conversation point when we get to that film. A film that's not good, the original, and maybe not the remake either. But sometimes, is that good? So we'll talk about that in some detail in that conversation. On the TV side of things, I'm working my way through Three Body Problem, and I do plan to have a conversation about that at some point in the near future, hopefully within a week or so. And do expect, as other Academy Award nominated, other important films from last year become available to stream, I'll be having additional conversations about them as well. And the next thing Sona and I will probably be covering would be Ripley, the new adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is coming to Netflix next week, much delayed, originally a Showtime production, but now popping up on Netflix finally. And in the wake of the television series You and Saltburn and in general, these Eat the Rich type comedies and thrillers that we've had in the past few years, it does seem like the right time for a Ripley adaptation. As I mentioned in the last episode, I am now on Letterboxd, so if you'd like to follow me there, just search for Needs Intro, Needs Some Introduction Podcast, or check the links in the show notes. And as always, email us with your feedback, needsomeintroduction@gmail.com. Okay, on with the conversation.
All right, so Sona, I had suggested a whole bunch of things we could possibly discuss. We haven't talked since Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which, by the way, to follow up on that conversation, I was like, we're not going to see a second season of this. This is just one of those shows that comes and goes, a one season thing that they throw some money at someone who had like a following to see how it would do. It actually did really well. So maybe we will get a second season.
It was so entertaining. But I do think they would need a new Mr. and Mrs. Smith based on how the season ended. But
they did leave it ambiguous. You could rewrite that ending. I know your interpretation hasn't. But that, by the way, anybody who hasn't seen that show, that's not a spoiler because I think it is open to whether they would have a second cast or not. Although just in favor of Sona's argument as to whether they can have a second season with the same cast. The rumor was that they were looking to maybe recast.
I think that could be a great idea to have a new Mr. and Mrs. Smith each season.
An anthology.
With different people that have their own followings, like known actors and actresses. I think that could be really interesting, actually. It could be in different parts of the world, even. There's a lot of potential there, I think, if you want to capitalize on it.
Actually, it could be fun. Imagine we do have an ambiguous ending here, arguably, in this season. So you could say, this is why we have a new cast. And then who knows, maybe the original cast members, or at least some of them, pop up again later on. And oh, what did happen?
Yeah, the way they ran into a different Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Yeah.
Exactly. Anyway, we'll see if that happens or not. There's a lot of shakeups. A lot of these streaming services are actually going to go away pretty soon. So we'll see how things look in a year or so. But this was popular. I think it's one of the most popular premieres ever for Amazon Prime, or maybe the most popular they ever had, although it was a binge. So that kind of puts the thumb on the scale. But I do look at the Nielsen streaming ratings, and the ratings for that show went up the second week versus the first week. So I'm like, that's a really good indicator that people were finding the show.
Deservedly so. It was so fun.
I wanted to talk to you about Anatomy of the Fall, Anatomy of a Fall, which was Academy Award nominated. Surprisingly, at the time, I was surprised how financially successful it was when it came out. It had won the Palme d'Or in France and in the U.S. Worldwide, it's a very big hit, but in the U.S., usually you don't go for foreign films. And then I actually saw the film. I saw it probably almost 2 months ago at this point, right when the Academy Awards were announced. And I was really surprised that the vast majority of the dialogue in the film is in English. So I'm like, it should have even been bigger, in my opinion, especially considering how it's almost all in English. But I was very curious for you to see this for a few reasons. We, of course, our most popular coverage here on the show was White Lotus, The White Lotus. And that was very much about the questions about looking at a relationship from the outside and questions about that. And we, in general, I think you and I have gravitated to enjoying having conversations about that.
Yeah.
Not only within the context of relationships, but just in general within the context of like perception and reality. So that I thought was really interesting. A huge theme, obviously, in this show. But of course, it's also a courtroom thriller, which A, you like courtroom thrillers. You like psychological dramas. I have a question for you as to whether you see this as a psychological drama, because I really do think it's, in a way, exciting to me just to watch it as a genre exercise, because I think it is a psychological drama. It just is in a very different vein than we're used to seeing them in.
I agree. I would put it in that genre, but very atypical for that genre.
Yes,
not
exactly
something that I have really seen done before in this way. Although certainly there are courtroom psychological dramas, but the dynamics in this particular one and the context of it are very different.
And another reason I wanted to get your feedback on this is because I was fascinated not only to see this French procedural and the way that the court system works in France, but there are so many articles, and I'll link to one in the show notes. Just one that you could see in Vulture, where one of the movie critics is just questioning a French lawyer and asking, how accurate is this? Basically, what it comes down to is everything in it is legally accurate, although, and we can get into it when we discuss the actual plot, because I don't want to spoil anything. Some of the things probably wouldn't happen the way they happened, but it's not when you have, for example, in murder mysteries in the U.S. where suddenly the defendant starts screaming out in the middle of the courtroom and someone blurts out their confession and they're like, case closed. That's not, like, all of that is made up. But this, the procedures that we see in this drama were accurate to the court system as it works procedurally, which I thought was fascinating because it's not at all how the American system works.
The format of this is bananas to me. And
right,
the Americans could never be trusted with this format. It would go off the rails so fast to allow three or more different people to be speaking at once while just interjecting with their own questions and perspectives. It would never work. We don't have the discipline to carry off something like that. I think you need a more straight-laced, uptight country. I don't know. The French aren't known for being uptight, right? Like with their relationships and stuff. But I just think there's no way that anybody could be trusted to have the self-discipline in the U.S. to allow other people to finish their thoughts and reasonably interject when needed and not dominate the conversation and take the whole thing. I don't know. It was bananas to watch for me.
I agree. And fascinating. That's part of the reason that this is maybe my favorite movie of last year, because it piqued so many interests for me. And one of those is I really like when, even just watching a documentary, and I see a different, not necessarily a different aspect of the world, which of course I do, but sometimes just to see something that you know, but from a different perspective. And I thought just the court proceeding stuff here was so fascinating to be like, wow, I literally would just sit there and stare at the screen and be like, would I rather go to court in this circumstance in the US or in France? And I was just, so even that was just so fascinating.
Yeah, it was also, as someone who's very used to the typical format, confusing. Like, why is she sitting over there? Where is the jury? Are these people the jury or are exactly. those people the jury? Like, where'd this guy come right. from all of a sudden in his robe? It was just very, there was a lot happening.
So let me set the table a little bit and then you can interject as much as you want. No spoilers here. I want to be clear about it. I can't imagine anyone that I wouldn't recommend this movie to. I know it's a very slim minority, by the way, because audiences really like this film. Critics almost unanimously like it. And I think there is this slim minority of people who hate this film because they just think like these people shouldn't be together and blah, blah, blah. I recommend this to everybody because first of all, even if you hate it, you are going to want to have conversations about it. And you're going to be amazed when you have conversations with other people who've seen it and they have completely different perspectives on things that you think is obviously this is what happened. And you're like, nope, that's completely the opposite of how most people see it. So all of that, I think, if you enjoy that kind of film watching, it's very satisfying. And I very much enjoyed it. So do check it out. It's on Hulu. I don't think I said that before. It's on Hulu. So check it out there. It's very easy to watch now and very entertaining. I enjoyed it very much. But just to set it up, no spoilers yet, but we will warn you when we go into spoilers. You have to have spoilers to talk about this show, this film for sure. But basically, we have this woman played by Sandra Hüller, who also, by the way, was in The Zone of Interest this year. Also very interesting film, very different film, but great actress. And she is home with her husband in the opening scene of the film. She's being interviewed by a student slash journalist, a younger woman. There's some weird tension between them. There's passive aggressively. Her husband is playing a instrumental version of PIMP by 50 Cent.
Music choice. And I wonder how much Crazy. Thought went into which song to use for this because we hear it so much. And yeah. I think it was a great choice, but I'm fascinated how anyone could have landed on this. I can't figure out what the thought process was that led them to the reggae version of this rap song.
And by the way, some just small detail so early in the film, as a film watcher, you immediately know that you are in great hands because this is such an incidental point. Like you said, Sona, it's like that song is going to be stuck in your head after you watch Leave This Movie Theater. And just like you could just analyze not why did the filmmakers put that song in there? Why was the husband playing that specific song? Even that is so well thought out. And everything in the film, I think, is really thought out to that
level. They're in the mountains with the snow, and we're hearing like the steel drum, the kettle drum, whatever you call when reggae bands have that. Just is so discordant. It's just, it's a really interesting choice and one that worked surprisingly well, I think.
Why would they play this song? What's the history? Why does he like this song so much? Did they hear it on their honeymoon or something? But also just the idea of they want to put this song in your head, like this song that you never probably heard in your life. And you put it in your head for the rest of your life. Now, every time, if you happen to hear that, I'm sure it'll pop up now that it's become a thing. And you'll be like, oh my God, it's that song from Anatomy of the Fall. So anyway, so we have that opening scene. The music's being played very loudly. There's something passive aggressive going on here. They have a son. The son is washing the dog, bathing the dog. He has limited sight. We find out circumstances of that later. He takes the dog for a walk.
Weird choice to wash the dog and then immediately take the dog for a walk, by the way.
And there could be something to that too, right? Like he knows they're fighting and he doesn't want to be there for it, right? So there could be that aspect of it also. But they go for a walk, not a very long walk. They return to the chalet or the home where they are, this beautiful location in the Alps between France and Germany. And the husband, his father, has fallen or been pushed out of the upper floor where he was doing some woodwork, smashed his head, and he calls out to his mother. She runs outside, calls for the ambulance. And then what happens from that point on, and we learned something about the French judicial system right there, is that rather than having a innocence until proven guilty type set of proceedings, the idea is if it is reasonable that she could have been the perpetrator of a murder, then there is an investigation. And that's the whole gist of the film, is delving into how this investigation happens. How do you go into a proceeding that forces you to ask, what is the truth here, when perhaps the truth is unknowable? And then there's an open question as to how guilty she is. That in and of itself would be fascinating. But to me, the real fascination here is suddenly that as I'm watching the movie, I slip into the trap that juries often do, where you start saying, this was a bad marriage, or she's in the right, or man, he was a jerk. And then you start deciding whether you want her to get off or not based on whether you think they had a good marriage or not. And I'm like, that's not what we're trying to figure out here, which made me continuously check myself as I'm watching the movie, which I thought was really smart.
I will say, before we get too far into discussing the substance of the movie, I just want to note, and I'm sure you said, I must have missed it. Is it a French movie? Is that its origin?
Yes. So this is a French production. Yes.
Okay. So it always strikes me the different standards for actors in Europe versus America, because, and I'm trying to say this gently, the casting of this would have been completely different in the US. Like, these are very real looking people. And that is something that I really enjoyed about it, is no one is distractingly good looking. Let me say that. Except maybe that one attorney. He went, his very striking look.
I was going to say, the lawyer, her friend, the lawyer is a very striking
He's
person.
He's a very yes. striking look. Yeah. But I like that everybody looked real and like somebody you could actually meet in your everyday life, in contrast to the very, very polished perfection of many American actors.
One thing I would add to that, though, is I think there's an intention to that as well, because, first of all, I agree completely that French actors, German actors, et cetera, get to have more normal looking bodies, more normal looking appearances, get to look like average, everyday, middle class people. But I would say, if you see Sandra Hüller at the Academy Awards, where she was all dolled up and maybe like wearing something more form-fitting, she looked way more glamorous there. So I think there's some intentionality that this woman would not look glammed up living in some mountain village.
Right.
Like, so I think that she's very much intentional that they allow her to look like a more average.
Yeah, I appreciate that too, then, if that's the case. I don't think that would necessarily happen here, unless it was like some actress being like, this is going to be my Oscar, and so I'm going to ugly myself up for this role.
Right. Yes.
Which we do.
Exactly. There's the making yourself ugly thing. Yeah. Too. Although I don't think Sandra Hüller as an actress, she was in German film Toni Erdmann from probably 7 or 8 years ago, which was very well received. And once again, she was not glammed up in that one either. I don't think that she plays the type of role.
It's not her thing.
She is glamorous movie star. But yes, I agree that regardless of how attractive the actual actors are, they in European movies, you're allowed to look like an
actor. I enjoy that. Person. Very refreshing.
And Swan Arlod, by the way, is this lawyer that Sona brought up. And fascinating, by the way, when he shows up on the scene. Let me get a little bit her biography, because it's important in the context of the film. She's German. She doesn't speak French very well. When she met her husband, we discover this over the course of the film. He's now living in his family home, or not in his family home, but in the town where he grew up. So she's moved there. They're working on their marriage. They have the son, obviously, has this disability. And there's some complexity to whether they would still be married or not if it hadn't been for these other blocks within their marriage. So that's an interesting line of thought as well within the context of the film, which is explored. That's not something you have to guess at. They definitely discuss it in great detail here as well. And this lawyer shows up who's friendly with the family, who seems to have a thing for her pretty clearly, actually. And he is there to ask her just like what happened. And she's trying to explain, oh, you don't think I killed him. And I love his response where he's just like, it doesn't really matter. That's not the point of this, basically. But yeah, he is. And he's so striking, by the way. I was like, I thought he had so much charisma and he has such a unique look. I'm like, I got to find other movies this guy's in. Sure. I want to see other stuff he's been in.
Totally.
And I've really never seen him in anything else. So I'll have to actually track down his. But is there anything else you want to add without spoilers before we jump into?
Not without spoilers.
Yeah. And then that sounds like we've really barely sketched this out. This is everything I've said about him showing up and this investigation beginning is really just the first 20 minutes or so of the movie. And the rest of the remaining, that's 2.5 hours. So yeah, so maybe there's a remaining 2 hours after we get past this introductory section, which really just examines this relationship and how much of truth is knowable within a marriage, within the people who participate in the marriage, bystanders trying to investigate a crime. The very fabric of reality is really fascinatingly explored in so many different ways here. And it really begins with this kind of, and maybe this is where we can start the conversation. This is something I didn't know anything about, Sona, that the judges in this French system, you have three judges and there's the investigator judge. The investigation is not led by the police. There is an investigating judge who goes to the scene of the crime, asks for forensic analysis and everything else, pre interviews everybody who's involved in the case, including the suspect. If the suspect says, hey, I want you to look into this, I want you to do this, the investigating judge will pursue all lines of investigation. And then when they go to the courtroom, they are like the referees as everybody talks. So the other judges get to vote. You have to have a majority decision, of course, the three judges. But the investigating judge always takes the lead because they have basically built the case around their investigation. And now everybody's going to interact with the court in general, which on paper sounds like a fantastic idea for a way to run a court. But I'm curious, right, just to start the conversation there, when you hear that is the way the system works, does that scare you? Does that encourage you? Like, how did you feel about that as a lawyer?
I think it sounds like a mess. I think people by their nature have their own biases, and it is impossible to separate yourself from those biases. And so unless you have a side that you are advocating for, you will decide in your head what you think really happened, and whether consciously or not, you will build the case from that perspective.
Yeah, I see your point. Although, and I agree that there's always going to be a personal bias, and that could go one way or the other. Although then you have a judge who, unlike a jury member or a prosecutor or a defendant, which may always take a specific point of view, I do wonder if it maybe is a better system, because at least you have someone who's like a professional who basically is trying to be build an impartial case, to be the shepherd of that. Because I feel like in our system, and once again, you're way more intimate with this than I am, but I feel like there are way too many variables. What's the makeup of the jury? What's the makeup of the venue in which you're presenting this? Is the prosecutor significantly better than the defense? Is the defense biased against their own client? It seems to be there's just more potential weak points.
There are more, but to me, I would rather that risk be distributed against through more variables than one person who maybe does not have your best interest at heart. I don't know or recall what the standard was for guilt there, but with the U.S. standard of like guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, it gives you as a defendant a very clear perspective of what threshold you're going for, right? And you would want to explore all avenues that could lead to that reasonable doubt. I'm not sure if that's the same thing in the French system. To have that, and then in contrast, someone saying, I'm going to build this case so that nobody could ever conclude that it was anybody but the defendant who did this. Those to me are so diametrically opposed that you could not expect one person to do both of those things extraordinarily well. I don't think it's humanly possible.
And now I think we should get into spoilers. But before we get to spoilers, one more thing before we can discuss briefly is this dog won a special award at Cannes.
Dog might be a murderer, first of all.
That is a theory, but I have my theory as to why that's not true. But there is a theory that the dog is like the reason the movie opens on the dog. First shot of the movie, by the way, is the dog that people say, aha, it's the dog. But I can debunk that immediately. However, the dog got a special award at Cannes, perhaps.
Sorry.
And also the dog was all over the Academy Awards. They use the dog, Rocky, I think his name is, during the Academy Awards in multiple cutaway skits. And the reason this dog has become such a celebrity is because this dog gives one of the best animal performances of all time. And I'll just say that when they taught this dog how to play dead, they really taught this dog how to play dead. It is shocking. I'm like, is that dog actually dead? What is happening right now? It's incredible. It's really incredible. One of the most amazing animal performances I've ever seen in my life, for sure. All right, let's go right into the spoilers now. There's so many questions I have. I do want to maybe the biggest one, we have to cut out some space for this, is to ask to whether you think she did it or not, because that becomes so contentious. But there are so many other kind of littler mysteries that I want to get your opinion of, or really not even mysteries. In some cases, it's almost just moral questions about the actions within the relationship.
I don't think she did it. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think so either. Maybe we won't have a good argument.
She just
about
doesn't,
that.
From what we have seen of her character, she just doesn't seem like the type of person that would push her husband in that way. I could, obviously, we have the recording of when things come to a violent head between them, but I still think from what we saw in that particular scenario, it doesn't make sense that she would do such a thing. I could, it's just what we've seen about her character, I could almost see her doing it in like a more calculated way. I don't see her doing it in this passionate way if she were going to do it at all.
Yeah. And I've only seen the film all the way through one time. I've rewatched a few scenes, but I knew the basic premise of the film going in. You know that from the trailer. I was very attuned as to whether I would read her as, is she guilty? And I would say, sure, Sandra Hüller is an incredible actress, obviously. She's truly incredible in this film. She has to put on so many different facets, and she's believable in all of her performances. And she has this level of ambiguity where she's giving a passionate defense, not specifically about the murder, but about other aspects of her relationship. And you buy her no matter what she's saying. So it's like really a complicated and a believable person that she creates. So it's a truly astounding performance from her. But regardless of that, I just think that she's embodying that character. And I think all the way back to the first scene when the son shows up and the husband is bleeding out in the snow and she comes running down the stairs, I just don't think that this person, if she was a murderer, would be so shocked by what she's about, what she's seen. Like, I'm just reading the text
of
the film.
I agree. It was a very authentic reaction.
I think that if she had pushed him out, then that character, specifically that character, yes, she can be a good liar. She can be conniving. She can be selfish. All those things are abundantly clear. But the utter shock she shows when she sees, she'd have to be an incredible actress. And I don't think that we see this character as being that type of person. This character, she will just tell you to your face, I don't care how you feel about this. That's the type of character she is. That type of personality is not someone who's really good at faking seeing a dead body for the first time. Like, I just don't think those things go together.
I also think, and I didn't think about this at the time, but now that we're talking about it, even though they are disparaging towards her parenting at times, I think her love and care for her son is actually pretty clear. And I don't think she would set up a situation where the son finds the father's dead body, because that would obviously be very traumatizing for a child. So I didn't think about this yesterday when I saw it, but now that we're talking about it, I think she cares more about her son than to put him in that position of being the one that found him.
I think that's an excellent point that I hadn't considered. I agree that I think that even if she had lost her cool, that she would have gone out of her way to make sure that the son didn't stumble upon the body at that point. Okay, a couple more moral quandaries for you. That's the big one, obviously. So the next question, do you think morally she is culpable in some way for his misery, her husband's misery, in the fact that she had stolen that one part of his story? What do you think about that?
No, I think she's a convenient scapegoat for his misery. I think
we sympathize with her, which is funny because a lot of people do not sympathize with her at all in this film. And I agree with you. But
I think what's so interesting, do you want to talk about that conversation where it all what happened?
Yeah.
Okay. So first of all, just the context of the conversation is that he's unknowingly taping her. So that already to me is a little twisted, especially when, as they bring up, was he picking a fight with her in order to get this reaction recorded? The conversation is fascinating because it's so much of a role reversal of how we typically hear this conversation that has become really popular in social media in the last few years about mental load and emotional labor and how much of that traditionally the woman does. And I agree that often the woman does shares a disproportionate amount of mental load and emotional labor. I think what this conversation, though, brings to light is, first of all, two things. Do we take it the same way when the roles are reversed? And in which way do we take it differently? Do we sympathize more with who would traditionally be the man, but is the woman here? Or do we villainize her more, saying, like, how could you possibly let him, I don't know, do more than 50% of the parenting, possibly on his own volition, which is something women choose to do constantly? And I think I had a conversation with a friend over the summer about this, actually, about how we feel like, oh, there's so much mental load, there's so much emotional labor. But then, you know, as we're talking, we were like, but if we tried to explain that to our partner, he would say, this is a choice that you are making to do these things that go the extra mile. And the world is not going to fall apart if you don't do these things. And if you didn't figure it out a week ahead of time, you still would have figured it out before the deadline, maybe a day ahead of time. These are choices you're making that are adding this stress and anxiety to your life. Now, if you value the results of that enough to bear that stress and anxiety, that's your choice, but nobody's making you do it. Nobody's telling you to do it. And the world would not fall apart if you didn't do it. So like, how much can we really go around feeling put upon and as if, oh, the thankless work that I do to run this family, when really like the family will not descend into chaos. It might be a little hectic, but it's all going to work out fine. Nobody's health and safety is being compromised. It's just, I like to do holiday cards, right? I have arranged that when we're going to do the family photos, and now let me order the card, and now I have to stuff the envelopes, and I got to get the holiday stamps because that's the thing that I have chosen. So then can I really complain about it? So like in this scenario, he has decided to homeschool this child. That is a tremendous amount of work that apparently to her, she's not got that so much conviction in the homeschooling. She would be fine with sending him to schools. She's letting him do it. It's important to him. But then can you hold it over someone else's head? Oh my gosh, all that I do that you never do. You never help with the homework. You never do this. But who asked you? Like, this is something you chose. And so I thought it was really interesting to see that conversation play out with the role reversal and where our sympathies lie with the role reversal. Yep. For me, my sympathy lay with the woman, because of the same conversation I had over the summer of I have to own the choices that I make. And like, given for me, this is a very first world problem. I luckily can pay to make certain problems go away, right? I can pay the holiday card people to print the return addresses. So I don't have to sit there and write them all out. So it's a first world problem. I'm not saying like every couple's dynamic is this way, but this is something we talk about with kids all the time. These are the consequences of your choices, right? Like, and this is what she's pointing out to him in a very calm way. That's probably infuriating him more, that like, you wanted to move back to your hometown. So that's what we chose to do. You wanted to try and renovate this place. So that's what you're spending time doing. You wanted to homeschool. So that is very time consuming. If your priority instead is to be writing, then you rearrange those priorities so that you can write. I'm not telling you not to do that, right? And it's all very logical and the type of thing I think that men tell women all the time, and we find it infuriating. Yes. When they do. Mm-hmm. We call it mansplaining or whatever. And you know me, and I'm not one to quickly take the traditional male gender side, but I think there's something to it in this particular situation, especially because they're under financial stress. I'm sure she would be happy if he could do something that actually brought in some money. And it does feel, again, stay-at-home mom versus working dad. You're asking for more from me when I'm the only one that's bringing in the money to pay the bills to begin with. Mm-hmm. So to me, I couldn't help but be on her side. And the thing with the idea, if it is the way that she said, hey, I think this idea is really interesting. You've abandoned this book. Can I do something with it? And he says, yes, have at it. And she does something completely different from how he had set it up, according to her. I don't know. I feel like at least someone did something with the idea that made money for this family, right? I don't know.
Yeah, see, we're on exactly the same page with this. It's funny because I've heard conversations and read essays where the perspective is so different. They just call her a sociopath in this moment, which I think is hilarious because oftentimes these are men who are calling her a sociopath and these reactions on its surface, just the dynamic of the moment, of the character in time. I feel like she's correct in her assessment of what he's doing, where he's, I have to homeschool, so I haven't been able to finish the house so that we can turn it into a Airbnb, blah, blah, blah. And she's, if that's a priority to fix the Airbnb, then finish that. You never finish anything, right? Just like you never finished your book. And then I took the one idea in your book that I thought was really good and I turned it into a thing and I was successful. And now you're mad because you didn't identify that thing. And in her telling of it, and I think she's correct because he doesn't deny it, she asked him, do you mind if I take this? And he's like, okay. And now he's furious because it was successful. Okay. And he's like, that could have been me.
But it wasn't.
And what's so interesting about the gendered, right. But that's what's so interesting about the gendered aspect of it, like you said, is that we have heard in the past, traditionally, that this would be the male perspective. And there would be a very unsympathetic read that the male man is being so self-centered and not thinking about all this work that the quote unquote wife is doing in this scenario. But I also think it's also, by recontextualizing it, it brings to fore something that is actually happening in the culture now. And you see it in like the Barbenheimer reaction as well, where men are in a way feeling like they are losing status now, right? Because they don't always, traditionally, they would always be in that role, whether they wanted to be or not. It just was what they were. And now they're, what role am I in? I thought I was the one who was going to have the successful writing career. Now you do. And I thought you're going to come into my hometown and then I'm going to be the big shot here and I'm living off by my own. And I don't know anybody here. And you're having people come home here to interview you. And this isn't the way it's supposed to be. So there's this kind of frustration that I think is happening as this kind of societal shift happens. Very intelligently, Juliette Trier, the female writer director of this film, who wrote it with her husband, by the way. Maybe they have a very complicated marriage, but she's a very talented director, I think, here as well. But to bring this up and be very smart to say, hey, let's take that traditionally sympathetic, put upon character, flip it on its head by gender reversing it. But then there's more to it there. There's like the whole psychological aspect of it. And of course, her putting this in his face is only frustrating him even more.
And there's also, which we skipped over, his role in causing the son's sight issue, vision issue.
Yes, yes.
And how much of what he's doing is the result of the guilt that he's feeling from that, which honestly, when they set that up, I thought it was going to be a much more horrific story than what it was. That like, oh, sometimes you neglected your kid and this is the type of thing that happened. I thought it was going to be something awful, like he was unsupervised in the house and I don't know, splash something into his eye that should have been locked up. Or this seems like just a terrible coincidence, but not one that I would attribute to, oh, you were so consumed with your own self and your own career that like, look at the consequence. To me, this was not, and maybe purposefully chosen to be a more ambiguous example of that. It just seemed like a horrible coincidence of timing. But yes, I could see beating yourself up. Over it and reacting the way that he's reacted, but then the wife would naturally become the repository for all the resentment of how life has not turned out as it was expected to.
I loved her performance in that moment where it doesn't even matter whether you think she's guilty or not. She's so honest in her assessment where, and we haven't talked about the prosecutor yet, that antagonistic prosecutor is incredible. Like I hated him so much as a character, but I loved him so much as a performance. I'm like, this guy is incredible. Every scene he's in, he's amazing. He's amazing. Like incredible antagonistic. Like just like his job is to just be like a dog with a bone, make her look bad at every turn. And he does such an incredible job and needles her on everything. But when he goes after her for this, I love her reaction to this saying that it wasn't his fault. It was just an accident. And then he's like, deep down inside, you have resentments. And she's like, I probably do, but I can't control that. I don't blame him for this, but yes, did I get colder towards him or whatever? Probably. Is that because I'm an evil person? No, it's just because I'm a human being was reacting to the situation. And I just felt like she was so exasperated by that, but in a very sympathetic way.
She resented him for a few days, which I think would be the natural, I don't know if you've had this, but I think there's always that natural instinct of a parent when something happens on the other one's watch. To be like, oh, yes, how did you let this happen to our one precious child? Like that, my husband and I always laugh that my kid had a day off from school. They went to the soccer field. He broke his finger. And I joke, like, it was on your watch. You broke our child. It's a joke. But I think there is that parental instinct. But there is also, right, the logical part of your brain. And this woman does seem very logical. That is, it easily could have been me in the exact same situation. I could have made the same decision and the consequence would have been the same. Like it, I think, yes, there's that emotional reaction, but then there's the idea of, yeah, they went to play soccer and the kid got a little bit overenthusiastic, jammed his finger into the turf. Like this, if it didn't happen today, it could have happened a month from now. It could have happened a month ago. It could have happened at soccer class or the team game. It's just, this is what life is. These things do happen. And you, if you're a logical person, you understand that, right? And you do enough self-examination to find a way to move forward from there.
Going back to just this, we're so caught up on this conversation, because, but in that recording, but I think it is the, you know, the fulcrum of the whole movie. I love when a filmmaker really has a strong hand. The film is so well designed. And then so many times the film is trying to pay something off and then the payoff doesn't really come. This happens with horror movies, happens with action movies. But with this movie, it's teased over and over again. There's this audio tape that's coming out. You're going to hear this audio conversation, and they're building it up and building it up. And the whole time you're like, I'm on her side. But oh my God, what is on this tape? And then when the tape comes out, it's so brilliant because it really does become the peak of the film. But so intentionally, it's like she's drawing all of our eyes to this moment in the film, the director, and then it pays off the film, but doesn't pay it off like as an action sequence or as here's the smoking gun of the murder mystery. It's what the film is actually about, which is all of this, the toxic dynamic of a relationship. And then the question as to until that point, you're like, they shouldn't have been together, or they should have been together, or she's the one who made their marriage bad, or he did. And then you get to that point, and all of it is laid out there. It's like you see his insecurities, but you see her selfishness, and it's complicated. And from moment to moment over the course of the conversation, it's like a really well done fight sequence or something, like in an action movie, where from moment to moment, he has the upper hand, she has the upper hand. But of course, all of that is within the context of he did this recording. Why did he do this recording? Mm-hmm. Why did he share this recording, right? So was he creating this on purpose so that he could say, oh, I'm going to write a story around this? And if he did share that with his friend, and that was his intention, it really does show you at that moment that he might have been in a really fragile mental state, which then also pays into the last section of the film.
Yeah. To me, what little we see of him and know of him, it is to me believable that he could have purposefully been needling her just to see how far it went. On the other hand, she didn't seem shocked by anything he said, or if you felt this way for 10 years, how come it's just coming up now, or however many years it's been? So it makes me think that these are real themes in arguments they've had, even though he might have been manufactured.
Yes.
She wasn't shocked to be discussing these things. So I don't think it was completely misaligned with what their relationship dynamic is.
Speaking of the gendered aspect of this, they touch on this in that argument. They touch on 100 things in that argument. It's like really just, you could write a whole thesis on just that argument from one section of it to the next. But one thing that comes up during that argument is that he, because he was on his antidepressants or because he's just depressed in general, had become very non-sexual. And then she was pursuing these outside relationships, but was honest about it with him. And what's interesting about it is going back to that Vulture article, once again, I'll link it here. They asked, I was surprised they brought up her sexual history because this is my, I know some French people, and this is my experience of French culture in general, which is that they were like, I'm surprised they threw her sexual history at her. I thought that French people were totally cool with marriage, with those kind of extramarital affairs. And the lawyer, the French lawyer says, oh, if you're a man, having an extramarital affair is totally normal. Not so much the other way around. So going back to what you were saying earlier, I think it's interesting that a lot of people probably do come away from the movie being like, oh my God, she was cheating on him. But especially since this movie is primarily made for a French audience, I don't think anyone made this movie thinking like it's going to be a worldwide blockbuster, right? And get nominated for Best Picture in America. Sure, that's going to happen, right? How many French movies have been nominated for Best Picture? I don't think that anyone was thinking it's going to become like a worldwide cultural conversation. But in France, I think that is very well known that, yeah, when you're married and you're a man, sure, you have extramarital affairs. Women, you're supposed to still be pretty traditional in your role. So once again, I think that it's maybe not a mistake that in the film, they call her out for this because it's, see, she's not a good wife. She cheated on him, which of course, going back to the whole gender swapped argument, if that was a man, it's just, yeah, of course. Yeah. Like the president of France has extramarital affairs in the open. No one asks questions about that. That's normal, right? So maybe the direct question I have for you about that is, how do you feel about her infidelity? Do you think that is something that was salt in the wound for him? Or do you think she had, for me, that's maybe her casualness in her response to him was maybe the cruelest thing she did.
Agree, but also, and we've talked about this in the context of so many shows, the dynamic of a marriage is only between those two people. There is no universal, there might be an idea of it, but to me, there's no universal reality of what marriage is and what marriage isn't. And we haven't seen enough of this couple to me to know if this is a complete breach of trust and confidence and devastating, or these are two people who have decided to build a life together. And there are certain things that they're just going to look the other way on because it's not worth it to them. Like, it's an easy thing to recognize as like a universal wrong. So you throw it in someone's face. But was the reality of it, that was such a breach in their specific marriage, I don't have enough of a sense to know.
Yeah, I take your point. I want to ask you about what the son does at the end. But before then, I have one specific question for you. And then I want to say anything else. You just saw it more recently than me. And I remember when I saw this, I literally, if I had taken notes, I should have. I probably would have like 25 questions that I wanted to review. So anything I might have skirted over. But before, the one more thing I did want to definitely talk to you about was something that for me was almost like an added layer to the film, which is when you have this very interior story, very personal from her point of view. And then you start seeing that it's becoming a media story. And there's this cutaway from her in the courtroom one time when she walks outside, and all of a sudden you just see all these people outside. And then you see her in the hotel room, and on TV, they're like, oh, the Black Widow, this, she's seducing her students. And two things that I found absolutely fascinating in that scene. One is that they said, can you imagine that she murdered her husband and she wrote about it beforehand? Can you believe that? And they cut to the other host and they go, whether she did it or not, wouldn't it just be a better story if she did it? Which I think is a commentary on our external view of these stories. But I love how that is superimposed. The camera pans over this like seductive Black Widow, and they pans over and she's under the covers, like eating a pint of ice cream. And I love the duality of just like, on TV, they're like, who's she going to snare in her trap next? And she's like depressive, like contemplating suicide in her hotel room. And it's like the juxtaposition between the glamorous representation and what's actually happening was just incredible in such a compact way to make that visible.
And I also think from a logical perspective, this to me was another reason that she didn't do it, is because it would be very stupid to write about wanting to kill your spouse and then
yes,
kill yourself.
Exactly.
Not that it hasn't ever happened in the history of time. I'm sure it has. But just when I was trying to, in an objective way, line up the evidence into different categories, like that to me was also against the idea that she did it.
I also love the argument that the lawyer makes, like going, yes, Stephen King's a serial killer, written about thousands of murders at this point. So I like how dismissive that whole thing was, but I did find it very interesting. And of course, so juicy. That's the type of detail that as you're watching the movie, you're like, that's not important, but you know that's going to be all over as soon as that comes out. It's funny, once again, how you experience the film from different perspectives. In the jury room, when they go, and she wrote about murdering a husband in one of her stories, you're like, oh, come on. She's a writer. Who doesn't write a murder mystery at some point in their careers, right? But then as soon as you hear that as her defense attorney, part of your interiority, you're saying, oh boy, they're going to run with that one. So it's a really well done.
I did read a little bit about the movie after I saw it. And one of the things that I read is that in one version, that is not the final version, she does have a romantic relationship with her
yes.
attorney, which I personally really appreciated that they did not go there. There were shades of it here and there.
Yes.
But they never actually went to connecting them romantically. Like they never really committed to it. And I appreciated that. I think especially as I approach middle age, I'm solidly in middle age, right? Technically, I just think there is not enough platonic male-female friendship in media. And this is something we talked about with the show Platonic, right? Of even in that show, at the end, they grew apart because there was like, to me, the show was having a theme of like, but then you grow up and you realize you can't continue those relationships on that level in that way of like being fun and carefree and whatever. And I didn't like that about the ending of that show. This obviously is a completely different context, but I like the idea that a fully grown man and woman can have a close bond without it being romantic. Although when I read, there was a version where they were romantic kind of undermined. But I'm happy they at least chose not to show that, because I think it's nice to have that dynamic. And why do you have to be limited to that bond with only someone? She was bisexual, so it could have been anyone, I suppose. But I think you get my point. I'm not saying it so artfully, but I think you understand my point.
I totally agree. I was a little disappointed. Just recently read the article. I think it might have just been within the past week or so, that article I think you're referencing, where she announced, or the director announced, that they had shot that scene. I feel the same way, because even in the film as it is, right, and I'll just read it as it is, regardless of what they shot, that final scene where they have that dinner,
yeah,
it seems like there's this longing where he wants more, but she only gives him a little bit. But I really feel like in that moment, once again, this is my interpretation, because obviously there is a version of the movie where they have sex with each other, that it almost felt like she was saying, maybe she has feelings for him and everything else, but this is a horrible idea.
I agree.
Sex with your lawyer, especially when you are like a celebrity murderer at this point, right? Like, so she's just like, this is as far as it goes. And I like the fact that there's that tension, but yeah, it didn't go beyond that. And I did think that was a smart way to go to cut that out. I also like that there's part of the definition or part of the argument that's been made as to how she is sociopath or something is that she's been separated from her son because of the circumstances of the crime. And all of a sudden here, she's been exonerated. And instead of jumping in the car and immediately jumping into the kid's arms, that she's proving she's a sociopath by going out for dinner with these lawyers and stuff. And I'm like, as a parent who rarely gets to go out on my own, it's, hey, even if it's a murder exoneration, this is maybe the last time I'll be able to go out for dinner with anybody for a while. So I'll take it.
That is so funny because I unexpectedly had a work dinner last week and the partner said to me, are you sure you have a family to go home to? And I was like, exactly. Grown-up conversation for like a whole evening? Amazing. Sign me up.
I thought you want to unpack this whole thing. What if he just gone through at this moment, right?
Jeez. I think they did a nice job with that little exchange between her and her son where he says, I was afraid for you to come home. And she says, I was afraid too, because so much has happened between them and they've been living with that. I don't think she was living there the entire time, that guardian type lady. And like the dynamic of losing the father, the murder investigation, living with that lady or having her around all the time and not being able to, she could only speak in French, right? When that lady was around and all of that, like, it's such an upheaval that I felt it was a very true thing for each of them to say, I'm scared to see what the consequences are of everything we have been through.
Speaking of which, let's talk about one of them really incredible. Once again, a film that has every single time I'm just like, wow, this is so great already. What can come next that's going to top it? And then we have the whole replay of the conversation that he recorded. And I'm like, wow, what an incredible scene. What can happen next? And then we get this scene towards the end where the son goes, I have something I need to say. And this is where he almost kills the dog. And because he gave some aspirin and then he had seen some vomit on his dad's floor and wanted to run this test. And then he talks to his guardian, like you mentioned, who's been living there with them, and says, what should I do in this situation? Should I just sit by and see what happens? And she goes, sometimes you just have to decide what's true and then live with what that is. I forget exactly the word she says, but she gives him a really good piece of advice. But then he takes that to heart. And in a really empowering scene, he decides to go to court and basically make a decision, give a testimony that will change his life. So he takes control of his life in that moment. But the question I have for you is, what do you think about what he does there? And more importantly, is that story true? Did it actually happen? Or more importantly, is it true in his own mind?
There's so much, I think, to be said about this, and I haven't even fully absorbed it yet, what was going on there. It's so interesting to me, this idea of like when you don't know what really happened, you just make a decision about what you're going to believe and move on so that you can go forward, I think is such an interesting idea. And it reminded me, I don't know if you've read the book or seen the movie. I've only read the book, Life of Pi.
Yes.
Yeah. It reminded me a lot about like the final scene in the book, which for all I know is the same in the movie. I don't know. But
it is.
You have read this very fantastical story about this boy in a shipwreck and surviving with these wild animals and right. And then everyone's like, how could you expect us to believe this? And he said, I could tell you this other story. Which is the better story? Which story makes more sense? Right. Like, which story do you want to be real with, like the alternative being very grim? Right. And so like this to me is like what he has decided, like this is his way of accepting what his reality was. Right. And it reminded me a lot about that. I do not think the conversation in the car with the dad happened. What do you think?
I definitely don't think it happened that way. I do wonder if the son, as kids are wont to, almost fantasize something and then believe it, like they get so vested in that thing. So I do wonder if he not only, he ran this experiment and he said, I saw some vomit on the floor and then could that have been? And maybe he did. And maybe he had a conversation that wasn't so on the nose. Maybe it hinted at some kind of depression that dad was going through or whatever. And he has now said, oh, he was trying to tell me he was doing this. So I do wonder if the child logic aspect of it turned it into that. And I think that's where the ambiguity is. I honestly don't think that conversation happened in that way at all. My bigger ambiguity is, do I believe that the boy believes this, or that the boy purely said, I want to make a decision now that changes my own life. I want to have some part of some control in what's happening, and that he's doing this. In other words, is he doing this purely pragmatically?
Sure. Is he rather than does he? His mom goes to jail, right? Like, is he going to move in with
exactly,
person?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. As opposed to just, or does he actually, has he, in other words, convinced himself that this is the truth?
This is a tangent, but I just want to mention, they make the point that he has a very good oral memory of oral A-U-R-A-L, yes. Right? Like listening yes. memory. They also make the point that he seems to either be remembering incorrectly or mischaracterizing that he, before the dad fell, was pushed, jumped, that they were having, the two parents were having a normal conversation. They were not angry. They were not yelling at each other. And that he heard that, even though they do these tests about how loud the music is and how could you possibly hear it. And he must have gone back in the house, but you didn't say he went back in the house. So there is a history there, perhaps, of maybe not being completely honest, or maybe having that child issue of remembering things in a different sequence and then making that the truth. I think there was something in that final testimony where he says, when I think of all the possibilities of what could have happened, her pushing him is not a possibility that makes sense to me. And I think really that's what it's grounded in. Here are my options. He tried to commit suicide. He fell somehow as an accident, or my mom pushed him out the window. And that's, he feels he can rule out that one. And so I feel like it all flows from.
To circle back to everything you just said right now, but also all the way back to whether the dog killed the guy or not. That I love this, by the way. The internet has run with this theory, at least some section of it, that the dog is the perpetrator. And that's what they're trying to tell us in the opening scene. None of that makes any sense. The kid leaves with the dog. The parents are talking. And to your point, by the way, I rewatched the opening scene again after I watched the movie immediately. And it's funny because they're telling him that you couldn't have heard the conversation. How do you know? They're making them scream at each other and saying, oh, they must have been screaming if he heard it. But if you replay the opening scene, it's exactly like he describes it, except for he gets the timing wrong. He says he was outside. When you rewatch the film, he's inside. He's putting his jacket on. He's with the dog. You hear them. She has immediately gone upstairs. They start talking. They're talking loudly because the music is still playing full blast. But they do not sound like angry voices, but we also hear nothing because it's just muffled voices intentionally. We do not know the content of the conversation. But he pretty much got everything right, except he said he heard it outside, and it actually was with the way we experience it, he's still inside putting his jacket on. But anyway, long story short is the dog leaves with him, and he comes back with him, and the guy has fallen out. And this all happened after the couple was arguing. So the dog could not have possibly been there, unless there's another dog we didn't see inside the house.
I read a theory, though, and listen, I didn't run down this theory. This was like a stray comment on a Reddit page, that he could have tripped over that ball that is in the opening shot of the movie.
It's possible.
That somehow he, because parts of that upstairs have no structural integrity, so you have to, maybe part of the floor is missing, part of something is missing. So maybe the combination of tripping over the ball and the house, I don't know.
You want to know what my theory is? I imagined this the second that the movie opens, when you see him upstairs and he has the triangular window pane and he's working and he has to close it partially and he's behind the window pane and then he opens it and he like has to work on both sides of the window pane. And I've similarly been in that circumstance where I'm like working on a window that, and then I stand up and I forget where, and I have smashed my head into a piece of wood or something that's there. And so as soon as I'm seeing this in my mind, when the movie opens, I'm like, this woman, they're going to investigate this woman as a murder suspect. And this idiot bashed his head on the window frame, fell out the window, and she's going to be accused of. But I've heard people say, for example, people have said, oh, the dog startled him and he fell out the window, or the dog accidentally knocked him out the window. Maybe the dog came up behind him. And I'm like, once again, I'm like, okay, he was sanding and fell out the window. I totally buy that. He smashed his head on the window frame and fell out the window. I totally buy that. That the dog surprised him. Once again, the dog was not in there when he fell out the window. And people have to stop making this argument. It makes no sense at all.
I'm on board with that. Okay. The dog didn't do it. Fine.
Yes. But it could have been, it would have been funny if the dog toy was up there and he just tripped on it and fell out the window.
Maybe it was a combination of your theory and the dog toy. He stood up too quickly and the foot came down on the bowl and lost his balance and center of gravity shifted. And next thing he's on the ground.
From my experience, by the way, of doing exactly that, where someone adjusts the window above my head and I like stand up too fast and like almost knocked myself unconscious. When the opening scene where he's moving the window back and forth, I'm like, that's what did it right there. That I'm seeing it happen right now in real time. Anyway, overall, this movie, I have only seen it one time all the way through. I could rewatch it and have different opinions. I think in general, I'm not going to convince me that he did it, to be honest with you. Although I think the film very much intentionally, they openly, everybody involved with the film has said that they, you know, don't know or they don't want to say what they believe. So it's intentionally left to be potentially open to interpretation. But I think a lot of the little details as to who's to blame within issues of the marriage, et cetera, are things that I might change my mind about as I watch this again. But all to the credit of the film, because how many times have you heard one member of a couple make an argument and you're like, I totally see her point of view. And then you have the other side. And you're like, wow, I didn't have this context. I didn't think about that. And then you can switch back and forth. So I think the film is, in a way, interrogating all of that. And I think it's really pretty.
Yeah, I think also something that it reminded me of in my personal life is that in my family, generationally, I have heard as people started to have kids, the older generation complaining like, oh, when I see them together, he's doing everything. She doesn't do anything. She looks to do all the work. And I just thought, oh, that's interesting. Before I had a child. And now that I had a child, I have a parent, lucky for me, who is very much a 50% parent. I think we really do split things fairly equally. I feel like that's what you're seeing is a couple that is splitting things more or less 50-50, but you are so unaccustomed to that it looks to you like the man is doing everything and the woman is doing nothing. And I was reminded of that in their conversation, of that because of these outdated roles, it feels like he is so put upon. But in fact, I think I did not see anything between her and her child that led me to believe there was some kind of like weakness in their bond, or that she was cold and distant and had never cultivated a relationship with him. And in fact, the one insight that we get into their relationship, I think, was very sweet when she was like, it was so important to me that he understand that like this doesn't define him, this eye injury, and he has his whole life ahead of him. This is his one life and he has to understand he can do whatever he wants. Like, I thought that was very much something that a very in tune, connected parent would say.
I love that, by the way. I just want to call that out. I thought I'd forgotten that until you brought it up again. I love what she says about his injury, where they're like, you hate him because your son is now like lesser than, and she's like, I can't think that way. Like, my son is who he is and he's defined by his limitation, but it doesn't impede his life. He has his hobbies and he has his life and everything else. It's just like the outsider, once again, this outsider perspective, this very simplified, you're angry because he did this to your son. And it's just like, I can't have that perspective, which honestly feels like a little bit of a critique. I think people are addicted to watching these, documentaries on these, where you have these very facile type of, the husband did it, and oftentimes they did. But there's also this very simplified narrative of what's happening. And I think, everybody wants that really simple narrative. And this whole film is about, all those things that you think you presuppose are all way more complicated than you expect. That's just another one where this idea of you're vengeful because your son is now disabled. And she's, my son is whatever he is. And I don't want any of these things to impede him. So why would I turn it into a thing if I don't want him to make it a thing? So it's pretty fascinating perspective on all of that.
Yeah, I thought that was really such a meaningful thing to say, a meaningful perspective to have for all of us about who our children are. And I think, again, gets back to the idea of when things don't look how we traditionally expect them to look, are we as open-minded as we think we are? Or do we fall back into those biases of this isn't what it usually looks like. This isn't what I've seen it look like. This isn't what it's supposed to look like. So there's something wrong, instead of it just being like a progression of how people have relationships and decide to parent and all of that.
All right. Thank you again for the conversation.
Thank you.
All right.
Talk to you later. Talk soon.